Future Friday. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Future Friday with Hamish Hallett and John Beasy. For this week we are speaking about the future of post-secondary education. So as me and John have either have finished our university degrees or are still going on with our university degrees, I think this will be a really interesting topic to kind of look into, especially with our personal experiences and the way we kind of use day-to-day life within these institutions. So John, my first question to you is what are the trends for post-secondary education? Do you see any kind of notable changes that is happening within this?
Well, I would say the big ones are the fact that education is becoming more and more important. You know, university degrees used to be, you know, the big thing. You got that and you were set. Now it's very much, you know, your bachelor's the new high school. You don't need nearly, you need more education to do the kinds of work we have. And so we need a more, I guess the bigger thing is overall change is how we've kind of structured our education systems. We've largely modeled them. They're front loaded. So you do pretty much all your education in the first 20, maybe 30 years of your life. And then that's about it. You're not really, it's not really set up to encourage people to come back. You're expected to be in that kind of degree or that field for your time. And if you go back to school, it's usually to, you know, get a master's or PhD, go more in depth. But as we're seeing that more and more people are, you know, out of work or need to find that they need to get new skills, need to move towards a more dynamic and fluid system that will allow people to continually upgrade and move towards models of lifelong learning rather than front-loaded more learning.
That is a very interesting point, actually, because I was kind of reading through a lot of information and it was kind of speaking on that, because I do feel that in this day and age, even though university degrees are pretty important and employers are looking for that, I feel like sometimes university doesn't teach you life skills. You kind of have to learn your own life skills by yourself. And even though, yes, you can organize, let's say you do essays, for example, you can organize your work pretty well, or let's say you have to do a bunch of reports, you can organize that. I don't think it's the same as within a workplace. I do feel like post-secondary education sometimes creates this, I don't want to say false reality, but like it creates a certain reality which might not be the same as in the real world, if you understand what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, I think I get what you're getting at. It's, I think partly what we're going to see going forward is not necessarily in the post-secondary level, but at least in, primary levels, is that it's going to be a move towards competencies rather than skills. So it's not so much a matter of, you know, teaching people, okay, can you do X, Y, or Z? What do you know? What skills do you have? But rather, in such dynamic and changing workplaces, what should be emphasized are rather competencies and, you know, characteristics. You know, can you work in a team? Are you empathetic? Are you how good are your communication skills? Can you resolve interpersonal problems? You know, how well can you work with other people? Because when the skills are always changing and have to be, you know, it doesn't really matter what you know over a period of 5 years. What's more important is like, can you roll with the punches and can you work with a dynamic team and workplace?
No, that is true, actually, because you've even got sometimes in education, you just have to be taught, you know, what the facts, what the figures are, I don't know, 2 + 2 = 4. And then, you know, all this kind of different sort of ideas and facts and figures. But then it's like, are you going to use that to then learn in the workplace? That's the whole kind of question. I kind of was reading one article, which was by Bold. We need to completely reimagine education. And it was kind of a quote unquote, instead of learning to memorize facts and figures, students need to quote unquote, learn how to learn, close quote, and how to solve problems, which I thought was like, you know what, that's what education should do, because I do think education, as our world is constantly moving forward and forward quicker and quicker and becoming more and more efficient, new issues, new skills have to be sort of, you know, it's been naturally created. But I don't feel like education is coming up to that kind of progression. It's still kind of remaining. It's like our education system is back in the, I don't know, the 20th century, even sometimes maybe even the 19th century, but our world is in the 21st century, but it's moving so quickly that it could be a 22nd century world. You know?
Well, we're still 80 years away from that.
Well, no, I know, but like, okay, maybe I'm exaggerating it.
But it's, yeah. No, absolutely. They should be focusing on, say, instead of teaching you, okay, this is how you use Microsoft Word, but maybe we're not using Microsoft Word in 10 years. Rather to be like, here's how to solve problems instead, rather to be a more dynamic and fluid person. Roll with the punches, not just, you learn one thing and like as soon as that changes, you don't know how to deal with it. Being able to work in new situations. And of course, yeah, have that, that teach the desire to learn rather than, learning it, keeping education as something that's kind of, something boring or undesirable.
Yeah. So how are kind of universities adapting then, John?
And I think an interesting one is, say, universities like McMaster University here in Canada and Cornell in the United States have both started offering their diplomas on the blockchain. So you'll also, you'll receive your fancy piece of paper with the stamp and seal and all that, but you'll also be able to receive a digital certificate if you opt in to verify that you have a digital component to your degree. So it's blockchains are essentially distributed ledgers. They're set up in such a way so only certain people can actually add to it, but anyone can kind of see it. It's very difficult to tamper because it's shared across every single computer that accesses it, and they all cross-reference each other. So they can't, you can't tamper with these kinds of things. So this is kind of this is the foundational technology for things like Bitcoin, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, smart contracts, and countless other things, even other new modes of social networks, and you can even create entire programs on blockchain. So it's the next big thing. So an interesting thing with, say, you can talk with a blockchain certificate is you can imagine, if you get all, you basically get your whole degree is essentially saying that you did X amount of credits, and you get a little piece of thing that proves to other people that you did it. So if we now can be done much more easily, where now it's like, okay, well, maybe you get a little block, blockchain, you get your credits on the blockchain. And so you can then move away towards, instead of having to do maybe your whole degree in 4 years, you have to constantly go back to school. Maybe you're constantly upgrading your education. You go and do one semester, you get your certification, and then you go to work. And maybe jobs in the future aren't saying, oh, you should have, you need to have a degree in X, Y, or Z, but instead maybe move towards, asking for specific courses in particular. I want you to have this, and this course, and for having these in particular skills. And so instead of having to go to an entire university and do 120 credits, and which only half of which usually goes towards your actual major, now you can maybe, go to university, do one semester, get those credits, and then, you have the skills you need for that new job that might only last you for a year, work a year, work 2 years, go back to school, and so on and so forth.
Mm. That sounds really interesting, actually, because it's a way of, I feel like it's a way of, it's like kind of constantly learning again and again. And it's not just, let's say you have your degree, you achieve a degree, then go into work, and then that's it. You're then away from education. But it's kind of, it's constantly on the move. And it's also it seems like a lot easier way of getting, your skills from university as well. You have this, as well, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's definitely more direct. It's a more direct way. There are also questions about whether or not you know, it depends on the other things you're kind of teaching, or because some arguments are also for you know, the whole university kind of gives you you know, the liberal arts education gives you a broader depth, or a, you know, supposed to give you a holistic view of whatever, rather than if you just take, you know, I need to take X, Y, or Z courses, you might not get some of the nuance or some of the breadth you might have gotten in other, in a, you know, more traditional setting.
That's fair enough. And you kind of feel like, because it's so focused on maybe certain elements, it's kind of neglecting others, and then you're not then getting the whole sort of picture of something. Is that what you're trying to get at? Yeah.
Or it's going to be very much, you know, it's education as an ends to, as a means to an end, rather than as an end in itself. You're not really treating education as I'm learning this because I find this genuinely interesting, but rather I'm learning this because this will be directly applicable to some kind of work situation.
Yeah, or it's like you've just been told to learn something because of a job, whereas you're not like personally doing it. Yeah, no, that's interesting. But then like kind of blockchain in itself though, as like a skill, it's quite recent. It's recently kind of growing a little bit, because apparently LinkedIn has said it's the most in-demand hard skill of 2020. So this is actually the actual blockchain itself. And I'm also seeing quite a lot of universities as well offering degrees on blockchain. So for example, I think I saw like Oxford, I think, was trying to offer this degree. So I think this blockchain technology is interesting. So, you know, I think a lot of these universities are seeing as blockchain is a very important technology. So,
well, like I said, it's the foundational technology for pretty much like a lot of the new things we're going to see in the future. You know, just cryptocurrencies, smart contracts, all these different things. I mean, you know, think of getting, getting your deed of the next house you buy on blockchain instead. And, you know, it can do so much, and, you know, replace, intermediaries in so many fields. I'm not surprised at all that it's the most in demand skill. And I'm not going to be surprised if it's going to continue to be the most in demand skill for a while.
Why blockchain? Why is it so? Why are loads of these businesses wanting people to use blockchain? Why do we want to adapt to blockchain? You know, why? What kind of benefits does it offer over, let's say, traditional ways? Do you say, if you know, any?
Well, a blockchain is, well, let's put it this way: on blockchain, you can create things like an entire currency separated from our current models of fiat currencies. You know, the idea is that there are these ledgers, they are distributed across all these computers. They can't be tampered with because they all have to be cross-referenced with each other. If one sticks out, it doesn't work. You can't really forge or tamper with these things. And if, depending on how they're set up, the different rules on who can add on to the blockchain and what the blockchain is exactly going to be structured for, because it can be structured in various different ways for multiple different purposes. You know, you can create a, you know, there are Facebook competitors, well, trying to compete on Facebook that have failed, but nonetheless, trying to create blockchain alternatives to Facebook. Or having, you know, a blockchain version of Messenger, or the big thing, which I would say is smart contracts, which is essentially, you know, a translation of, you know, a legal contract into a bit of code. So it allows for a smart contract, and essentially allow for a very rigid and controlled means of transactions. So many, you know, in your everyday life, when you're doing purchases or whatever, it's or doing kind of work, it's, you're making many kinds of informal contracts. And so if you have smart contracts, those can essentially do the work of many intermediaries. So those are people like realtors and many kinds of lawyers, because you don't necessarily need those intermediaries to make sure that the other person's doing their work. You don't have to put you put your trust in the intermediary instead of putting the trust in the other person. Now you can put the trust in the blockchain itself, because now to do things for you. So say, for example, you wanted, let's say you wanted to pay someone to paint your house. You wanted them to paint the house and the separate garage. You do a smart contract where the person, they have the two criteria, the house and the garage. And then when those two conditions are met, the money you paid that person is automatically dispensed to them. Okay. Without anything you need to do and they need to do. So as soon as they meet those two criteria, that's done for you automatically. You don't need anyone else to do it for you in the middle. So you can also put this up to a greater degree, say things like say housing. You want to go buy this property and like, okay, I want to buy this property. This looks really cool. I'm looking into it. Okay. I'm interested, but I want you to, do some slight renovations in the bathroom and do X, Y, or Z. And then there's like, okay, we can do that. But there's also, you need to fill out elemental paperwork. So the contract won't allow them to transfer. Like, basically, there's code making sure that each side is filling both sides. And until both sides have fulfilled their aspects of the renovations and filling out the paperwork, the money and the deeds do not transfer. But once they are, it's automatically done. And that can all be done on, a website done through, some tech company rather than having to get Remax or some other realtor involved, which lowers down costs and which will, reduce costs.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it seems like it will also increase a lot of efficiency and speed, greater transparency. Could also enhance the security as well. It's like you don't have to, let's say you want a contract, you don't have to send it via paper. Absolutely. You can do it online so easily.
Well, that's the other thing is these blocks are anonymous. Everyone can see the transactions, but they can't see who the participants are. So you can see, how much Bitcoin's being moved around, but all you can see are just the long alphanumeric hash numbers of their wallets, but you can't tell, it doesn't say, oh, this, this 256 character string belongs to Sally Sue. So it does allow for greater transparency, but also for anonymity.
That's the only thing though, would being anonymous be a little bit suspicious though? I don't know, that's the thing. Or would you disagree with it? Because I don't know, let's say you have a random contract that is on there and you don't know who it is, you don't know who it's from. Surely you're a little bit suspicious of that. Or are you not? I don't know if I'm missing that.
Not quite if I understand the question.
Well, it's like, okay, if you see on blockchain, you see that, let's say you see a contract that is on there.
Let me clarify this. There is no blockchain. They're different kinds of networks.
Okay.
So like a Bitcoin. So the Bitcoin blockchain is totally separate from different kinds. So from different other kinds of smart contract blockchains, and all these different blockchains, the smart contract blockchains, can all be different independent platforms. They can all also be competing with each other in the same field. So it's not like there's one universal blockchain.
Sure. Okay. Fair enough. Gotcha. Okay. Fair enough. That's fine. Because that was the thing. Because if I was thinking at first when you were kind of explaining it, I was thinking, okay, it's just one whole blockchain. Everyone can just post different things on there, and stuff like that. So I was a bit like, and then the fact that it's anonymous, it's like you never know what's real, like all that. But then the fact that you then said it's independent, different streams of it. That then makes sense. Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah.
And it's that just because it's anonymous, don't forget that what and how things can get added to the blockchain is something that is decided when the blockchain is created. So it's not like anyone can go in and create new Bitcoin. Rather, they specified you have to do the specific mathematical equations to actually mine more Bitcoin. Like they create the way in which who gets to add on to the blockchain.
Cool. Okay. So it's just not like a complete and utter free for all. Okay.
It can be if that's how the blockchain is set up to be, or it can be set up in a very controlled way. That's the flexibility and the freedom of the technology. It can be used in so many radically different ways.
That is interesting.
That's why it's the big thing. That's why it's going to be the next big thing, or it's kind of becoming the next big thing.
Oh yeah, 100%. I've kind of looked into, you know, they're saying that blockchain is definitely going to disrupt traditional business models and how global business operates. That was a lot of things which I was reading about this, because it seems that, yeah, you're saying it's the fact it's flexible. It's the fact that it's going to change businesses not to be so like rigid, or how like it's hierarchical and it's like set amount of transactions. It's going to be so different and very, it'll change it hugely. I think it definitely seems cool. And the fact that universities are now offering degrees as well, clearly they see that this is a very specific skill, 100%.
Yeah, or just the fact that they give you the degrees on the on their own blockchain. Well, now verify, exactly. Like, okay, yeah, everyone can see that, you know, they got these degrees, but now they can see that they issued degrees, but they can't see who received the degrees. But if you have the degree, you can prove that, hey, I have the file, and you can prove that, like, okay, my hash matches the one on the blockchain, so you can verify that when I get my degree. I say I have this degree, you can actually go and double check it and verify that I actually do.
No, that is definitely, yeah. It's very, very cool. The technology does sound exceedingly interesting and exceedingly very easy to be adapted as well, which sounds really cool. I do want to kind of slightly change the subject to this conversation though. Obviously we spoke about blockchain. Sorry?
Back to education.
Yeah, let's try and go back to kind of like education on it. We've kind of seen now, because of COVID-19, a lot of online classes have now happened to occur. So for example, you know, seminars, maybe even lectures might have to go online now. And I think both of us went to university in Canada, and we had to go, like, I know we already did like one seminar, which was online. I just want to kind of like ask this kind of more of a personal opinion question. Like, do you feel like online classes are better than in-person classes? And then, like, you know, do you like prefer online classes to in-class? Yeah. What kind of opinions do you have on that?
Online classes, I mean, they can be nice and convenient. They do have certain benefits. But I don't think they're quite there yet. Maybe not until they're VR, basically.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I know what you mean.
I mean, they're decent. And it really depends on like what you're learning and how you're doing it. Like, for example, we had our class, it was a small class of 12, a seminar of 12 people, and was largely discussion based. So, you know, when you're having a small video chat on Zoom, that's pretty manageable. And when it's largely just a discussion, that's something that's very easy to do online. I felt like our class in that regard was pretty okay. But I can totally imagine another ways. Say, for example, I have my cousin, he's learning to be, he's currently studying to be an esthetician. So he's currently doing like Zoom seminars, learning how to, like, here's how to apply this beauty mask. Like, okay, how do I do that? I don't have the equipment here to do it myself. I can't, like, I'm basically watching you do a tutorial, like on YouTube. And, you know, it's not quite the same. You don't get the same kind of feedback. You don't get, and of course, the other thing is you don't have the necessarily social aspects as well. Like, there is so much more, like a university and a school is more than just the curriculum. It's also the environment and where you go. And especially for children, so much of school is not just about, you know, making sure they're literate and know how to, and, you know, and have numeracy skills, but also just, you know, giving them social skills and teaching them how to interact with other human beings. And that's not necessarily something that you can really do in, you know, in a video chat, not to the same extent.
Yeah, I definitely know what you mean. I think just to kind of add on to what you've kind of been saying, this is the thing. I think with COVID-19 continues going on now, I think it's more than likely online classes are going to continue into autumn term. So I've looked into my university, for example, at Kent, and even though they haven't come out and said that online classes are going to happen, they've said that if anything does need to be mitigated and changed, then they will have to do it. And I think, because with the university I went to in Canada, when you were there, yeah, the classes sizes were so small. It was really easy. And our class, which we did online, was very easy to do when there's, 12 people in there. The issue is, yeah, it's when you have like lectures, which are going to have, let's say, 200 people. Now, at our university in England, they do record the lectures, which, okay, that's good. But I don't think everywhere else in England does that. So that's very difficult to try and do. And then on top of that, you've got seminar classes, which, again, encourages discussion. Now, it's a lot more than, I think, 20 people. Like, I think there's around 20 people in these kind of seminars. So again, it's going to be very, very difficult to try and do online, and a very big challenge. So it's definitely interesting, because it will definitely be, depending on university and depending, of course, you've been mentioning on the subjects, it's going to be interesting to see how online classes are going to adapt. Personal opinion, I like online classes because, yes, it's convenient, but I definitely think it depends on how many people are in there. It also depends on the seminar or the professor itself, because he or she might control the class really, really well. At times, someone else might control it really badly. So it's a lot of these questions are going on. And also the universities themselves have to adapt to doing this as well. I don't think some universities might do it really, really well, but some universities might not do very well. So it's a very problematic, well, I wouldn't say it's problematic, but it's a very interesting question that a lot of people.
There'll be a learning curve for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the thing. And I think I found out, it's just to add some personal information. I kind of was talking to my dad actually today. And he's kind of mentioned the fact that one American university is actually American university is being sued by a bunch of parents because of the lack of teaching, because everyone's going online and things like that, which I don't know what might happen then. So,
yeah. Yeah, well, Americans already have their, you know, their sketchy online universities.
Oh, really? So yeah.
Those are already a thing, which are, sketchy to say the least.
Yeah, sketchy. Fair enough. How do you mean by sketchy?
Well, you know, these are generally for-profit online universities. So they might not necessarily have the same kind of quality that you might expect, or the same kind of the same kind of accreditations you might necessarily want. They might not miss, and just because it's online, I mean, they kind of focus on, like, you know, it's online, it's easy, and you can get, and it's supposedly quote unquote cheaper, or you can work around whatever schedule you have. You know, and I'm sure many of them are legitimate, but there are other ones that are maybe don't have the proper accreditation, or, you know, you get your degree, but it's kind of, you know, you go and realize you don't really have, you didn't really learn anything.
Yeah, I know you mean, actually.
And it's also just the fact that, you know, some of these have been around for like, you know, for 10 years. So it could be like something like, you know, if you're corresponding largely just by like reading online textbooks and corresponding with the professor via email, you know, that might work in certain regards, especially if you can do well with self-directed learning. But, I would think the proper technologies and infrastructures for a really good online class just weren't there in the past and are just starting to emerge now. Once VR headsets are, you know, largely accessible, and then online classes are going to be much, much better.
Yeah, no, that's true, actually. I agree.
Because once you have, once you can meet in a virtual space, then, you know, you can have any kind of meeting with other people anywhere else in the world. You don't necessarily have to go, and you can have and it's the same benefit of essentially having it in person. You can be there, you can, you know, have your body language, you can present yourself as an avatar that's either, you know, you can present yourself in whatever way you like. And with the power of in a virtual environment, you know, that could be really, could definitely help be more immersive in your education. Imagine instead of, you know, you're sitting there and you have, you watching your your teacher give a PowerPoint presentation and just kind of like explaining what things are. Maybe instead you can, you know, imagine it's kind of like the magic school bus, but instead, you know, but in VR. So the teacher can actually go and show you all these things in a more interactive, in an interactive way that's, you know, much more engaging. Or instead of, you know, having to read about some historic event, rather instead you can, you know, go back and, you know, and see what it was like, a digital reconstruction.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I was seeing quite a few things, actually, about that. I just saw, like, an advert. I don't know, it was quite, not recently, but just I see it quite a few times, but the technology is there to kind of see this reconstruction, which is quite cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, like we have technologies now. It's just a matter of, you know, getting it down, getting it the price and cost down.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, and it's but a lot of these, sorry?
Sorry, it's also just to kind of like properly implement it as well without any sort of like hitches or anything as well.
Yeah, no, you definitely need, definitely the kind of thing that would be more, depending on what you need, yeah, a proper high-speed internet connection. And this is definitely something that would come more with, say, something like 5G than rather than what we have now, especially for if you want to be more mobile.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. That's interesting. And I just want to ask this question, actually. Because I feel like I wouldn't even say like just post-secondary institutions, but like education in general are kind of, well, when we were speaking about earlier, are kind of relying on a lot of traditional models of teaching and things like that. And I kind of found this really interesting quote by John Maynard Keynes, a very famous economist, in his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money. And this was on the preface. And the quote was, "The difficulty lies not in the new ideas, but in escaping from the old ones, which run five ... into every corner of our minds." Which is a really interesting quote. And I actually kind of felt like, you know what, does this kind of quote kind of link with post-secondary institutions? Do they need to adapt, or education in general, does that need to adapt away from old ideas into these new ones?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the whole, that's a very, I think that quote's quite applicable to, as he says, in every corner of the human mind, I think it's applicable to every human endeavor, you know,
there oh, yeah,
always
true.
Have these old ideas. Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of like the whole, I mean, yeah, education's definitely, you know, it's like having schools wake up at like 8 a.m. when it's been clear, it's been, you know, well established that meant, you know, that teenagers actually require more sleep and do better when they wake up later.
I know you mean about that. Yeah,
all those ideas are just the, you know, the very structured and time set way of particularly American education. And, you know, that's an older industrial model. That's, you know, the prime students for having that very rigid industrial work day. But, you know, if we're not really kind of having those same kinds of, you know, we're not in those same kind of workplaces, or the idea that, you know, we have school during from like, you know, 9 to 3 or whatever, when, because that, you know, lines up nicely with traditional 9 to 5 jobs. But if people aren't necessarily working 9 to 5, then maybe that kind of model work well.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree so much about the idea of, waking up or starting school at a certain time so early when you clearly have so much evidence of teenagers needing more sleep. It's actually true. Like, there's a bunch, because I've read this book, really interesting book. I think it's called like Why We Sleep, I think it is. Super interesting book. Really highly recommend it. And yeah, it shows the fact like teenagers need more sleep. Their circadian rhythms are so different from like normal adults or children or even older people and stuff like that. And it's the fact like, yeah, why do we start school so early? It just makes no sense. And again, it's what you've been coming back on saying, it's the traditional frameworks that are been implemented. It's the fact that, yeah, we have 9-to-5 jobs, but at the same time, that's changing so rapidly, especially like right now, COVID, during this whole pandemic, we've changed so much because, we're having to work from home now. It's like classes have to go online. No longer are we going from 9 to 5. We're kind of doing like, we kind of do our own hours most of the time now. It's no longer the traditional jobs anymore. So it's the fact like education might need, has, I think does actually need to adapt to that change. And unfortunately, I don't think it is, because I think it's preparing a lot of our younger generation, maybe us as well, and maybe even the older generation, maybe now. It's not, I don't think it's kind of adapting us. It's not teaching us what the real world is going to be now. It's kind of, yeah, it's not adapting. Let's just say that. That went on a
Well,
huge
it's yet to
tangent.
adapt. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, there's, it's, I mean, yeah, the changes now I think are largely, at least how they are in Canada, is largely kind of more superficial changes or, tweaking the system rather than changing the system as a whole. Like, oh, we're going to stop teaching handwriting and we're going to start teaching, typing or, or we might start, yeah, we'll stop teaching handwriting, we're going to start teaching coding or some others, or, digital literacy skills. But yeah, I think we definitely have to move towards, a more individualistic model of education. I think a good model, I think good country, good examples would be those of, say, Scandinavia, who have smaller class sizes, have and some models are generally students work more at their own pace rather than having to keep up pace with the entire class, which makes it easier for students to work, make them work, it makes more sense for students to work at their pace and at their own skill level rather than feel pressured to have to keep up and potentially fall behind or get bored because you're not moving far enough.
Yeah, that's cool.
All students are unique and have their own strengths and skills, or present different ways to make gamify things in different ways to make education more accessible and entertaining. So it can be it can be something that a student actually wants to do rather than be something that a student feels compelled to.
Yeah. That sounds
Nothing,
interesting.
nothing turns a student off more from a subject than being bored out of their mind.
Yeah,
No one
completely.
likes a dry, boring lecture, but if you get a nice, but if you get a good prof, good teacher who's passionate and exciting and presents it in really interesting ways and ways that make sense to you, then yeah, you're going to enjoy the subject matter much more. So it's not, it's also, it's so it's also about, meeting the student halfway and meeting the student where they are, rather than expecting the student to conform to these mass systems of, I guess one way to put it, standardized industrial education.
Yeah.
If we're going to move into a world where, you can have your bespoke shoes and everything's gonna be tailor-made to exactly how you are, why can't education be the same?
Yeah, exactly. It's the fact like, yeah, like if we're going towards a world of this and this, why can't education meet that? Yeah, definitely. Very interesting. And yeah, I just want to just do this like kind of last question before we go towards weak signals. What is the future of post-secondary education? Or let's maybe make it a bit more broadly, what's the future of like all levels of education?
Well, I think I you know, just said that.
I feel like you did say that. I think.
All those, you know, a new, more individualistic, more holistic approaches to education, greater, greater participation in the education, greater, self-control and direction, and, a move towards teaching, competencies over skills, teaching students how to be empathetic, teaching students how to communicate, teaching students how to solve problems rather than teaching them, this is how to, this is when you encounter to do this, and, just teaching them to memorize a book and then answer multiple, multiple choice questions rather than show them here's how all these different, and show them everything in isolation, but instead show them here's how all these different things work together and in interesting and connected ways, to show them how, how fascinating the world and interconnected the world is. It's not like biology is just so isolated, is an isolated monolith from chemistry and history and language, but instead you can show how all these different fields that apparently aren't related are actually intersecting.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. So yeah, it's trying to kind of bring everything together as one.
And then it's still, that kind of, that attitude of lifelong learning, and then having the systems so that they can facilitate those kinds of, broader approaches to education. So you're always going in, upgrading and training, and maybe in such a way, your training might be the work itself. Like what I was mentioning earlier, the Microsoft's HoloLens, which is kind of their VR headset for largely right now advertised for enterprise usage. So for corporate meetings and whatnot, but it can be set up, and they're also advertising it for training workers. So imagine if you are, at a factory and you need to assemble this this piece, rather than having to, read the manual on how it's all done, rather instead you can be learning as you work, whereas you wear the headset, it shows you step by step how to assemble things by showing, grab this piece and highlights the box and, through your screen, because it's augmented reality. So it's like clear glasses, but it projects digital objects that you can see and interact with. So it'll show you, and I'll go grab this piece, and then it has an arrow come around, like put it right here, and you screw it in, and it tells you to screw it in. And so as you're doing the work, you are also being trained at the same time.
Yeah.
So you can, not just have to, we don't have to even think of education and work as separate things, but we can, do training on the job, train on the job.
Do it like together and like interlinking it. Yeah. That'd be cool.
The future is now.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. It's crazy. It's crazy, crazy, crazy stuff. But this has actually been a really good conversation about, just about like education or post-secondary education. We'll find a way of like naming this episode, because I think we did go on post-secondary education, but also all levels as well. But this has been a good conversation. We'll just go on to our week signals for this week. I'll go first as usual. So I found a really good article by Horizon Canada, which was something called Bug Bots Harnessing Insects. So basically, it's pretty much developments in controlling bugs using technology. So it's the fact that we can find ways of putting, technologies, like little things, to kind of control insects, because I think insects are able to be controlled. There's some sort of science behind it. I won't go completely in depth about it, but they were able to find some sort of technology and attach it to a bug, pretty much. So things like, companies like Draper, someone creating a project called Dragonfly Eye Project. And then the US Navy has also been trying to making a bomb detecting locust, I think it is, which is interesting to see. So it's kind of basically this weak signal is trying to say that biodigital convergence can now be a thing, which is just not, it's saving time of not just, building a whole drone for robotics, but actually using the original species, like insects, just to use kind of robotics. So I think it's very, very interesting. It's been looked into, you know, the military, surveillance, environmental monitoring, search and rescue, and pollination. So there's a variety of different fields that they are looking into. Of course, we've also kind of talked a little bit about, you know, drones usage and things like that in these episodes, but there are some concerns about this, you know, in terms of the legality of this and also ethics. So again, I think this is a very interesting weak signal, because now bio-digital convergence can be a thing. Of course, we've got to argue, is this very ethical? Are we allowed to do this? You know, so very interesting weak signal. So yeah, what do you think about this, John?
Yeah, well, I think it's it has such wide and diverse approaches, and insects are so versatile. The applications could be nearly endless. But I think the other big question is the ethical and moral question of, can we control insects in this way? I think a lot of people are they separate animals from insects. And when they think of, if you were to think, I'm going to, put this chip inside this dog and basically take over its brain and, control it, or, let it run autonomously, but then make it do other things when I want it to perform my end and treat it as some kind of expendable object. I don't think, a lot of people nowadays, I don't think are comfortable with that, with animals.
Of course not.
But then when you think of it, what if you did it to a spider? Are you okay with doing it to spiders? Are you okay with, breeding millions upon millions of all these insects for such expendable purposes?
Yeah.
Just treating them as these, as machines with organic compounds rather than as individual living things.
Mm, absolutely. It's like, it's like even if, let's say, let's say vegetarians or vegans are like, don't want to eat meat, don't want to eat fish. What if they eat like bugs and something? Is that the same thing? It's like, never know. Actually, I don't know if they would eat bugs, I know where you're coming from. It's like, yeah, we kind of look at spiders and we look at bugs or flies or insects as like not the same thing as like dogs and cats. And it's like, they sort of are the same sort of things. They're like, well, they're not the same sort of things, but they're like animals in general. Are we like more accepted to control insects?
I mean, just because they're small and have a lot of eyes and legs and they're generally off-putting doesn't mean that they're not alive and have less of a right to exist than anything else. What makes us the arbiters of what's allowed to live and what's not?
Mm. It's like how we test products on like rats or, actually we kind of use monkeys as well. It's like, in the same sense as that as well. So interesting. So yeah, what's your weak signal as well?
I have one about an urban planning AI.
Okay.
So this is from researchers at Bell Nokia Labs. They developed an AI system called Facelift that uses a crowdsourced aesthetic sensibility to redesign the looks of city streets. So the AI can take an image of a city street and beautify it. So over the last 7 years, MIT has been showing volunteers images from Google Street View and asked them to rate them as beautiful or ugly to develop its taste. And so the AI tends to prefer narrow, compact streets with lots of greenery, sidewalks, crosswalks, and other amenities. So it's designed with, say, beauty in mind, and other urban planning AIs are in development, it can help with some of the more practical dimensions in that, cities are expected to grow in the coming decades, and we need to find ways to use resources more efficiently and minimize environmental impact. In many cities, especially here in North America, are very car-centric, not very people-centric, and built primarily and have lots of sprawl. They're not, they're sprawl, not tall. And so this contributes to both climate change and reduces economic opportunities for those without cars or proper access to good public transit. So these urban planning AIs could help design towns and neighborhoods that are not only aesthetically pleasing, but also more human accessible and walkable. But at the same time, creating these kinds of using AI to design cities might create a kind of homogenized aesthetic where, it's part of the, it's those little irrationalities that kind of help make city streets charming.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It might kind of lose. Yeah, exactly. It might lose its uniqueness. Mm-hmm. Let's just say.
Like if every city just has the same grid with the same trees and the same crosswalks and the same places and all the same layout everywhere, then what makes each city different from the other? It's the little idiosyncrasies that make cities unique and have charm and distinct from one another. It's the fact that this intersect. A five-way intersection is terribly inefficient, but it looks and they're not coming at nice even angles, or this tiny, random, super acute intersection that's not really safe or looks good. It's not really safe and not necessarily rational, but it's those kinds of little idiosyncrasies that help give a city its charm.
Yeah, I think it would be cool to use this technology, but I'd say it's actually best. I think it would be good to use this technology just because, yes, it would definitely tackle any issues if it's, if it's not good for pedestrians, if it's constantly looking for good for cars and stuff, which cars contribute a lot to the environment, then of course it can change it and make it a little bit better for people. Does it also change sort of light? This is gonna be a super random question, but does it change like lampposts and places of light as well? Just because I wrote an article about light pollution and the fact that I think we overlit our neighborhoods too much. It actually causes a lot of light pollution and creates birds being killed because they run into buildings, for example. So could this technology maybe find a way to eliminate a lot of light posts, lampposts and stuff like that, make it better in that sense? I don't know if it would, or maybe that's a different thing.
Actually, I think it would work with if you had another system that could monitor traffic at night and see where people go and where people don't go. It'd make more sense to maybe not put up the post itself, but I think would rather you want to move towards a different model of lighting. So maybe instead of having the lights go in all directions, you project it just down. Maybe they have sensors, so they're they can dim and turn on as people move into the area as needed, rather than just we're gonna have light on all the time just in case someone might be here, but no one's actually walked here at night since for 3 weeks. So it's both to save energy and to minimize light pollution. I think it can be used in these useful ways. That's the fun thing about the good thing about this AI is it can, when you combine it with all the other kind of information you might want to use as an urban planner, it can definitely help streamline the process of figuring out where to put things.
Absolutely.
Where the optimal places to do certain things might be, based on how people move around and use the spaces.
Yeah, no, it does sound really cool. Definitely, yeah. I think this technology seems like a really good idea, but of course you don't want to over edit certain cities and certain towns or certain roads to then look exactly the same, because then that's a definite question.
I think the big thing is largely just not really, you don't want to blindly and fully apply it, but rather I think a lot of these systems and a lot of these tools are these kind of AIs, I think are largely tools to be used by human urban planners. It's rather than relying on an AI to create all the cities for us. Rather, it's like these are tools that can help, it's kind of like when you suggest, the AI can suggest an urban planner, hey, I think you might want to put this here. But ultimately, the decision rests with a human.
Yeah.
And they're allowed to make these changes and do no, actually, we don't. Or I see. The AI says we should probably, bridge over. But I don't know. It's it's very important, it has a lot of cultural significance, so we can't actually touch it because it would make the people upset.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that actually would be good. Yeah, I think definitely using this AI as a tool, rather than using this tool to then project a potential end. It's just a suggestion, maybe. Yeah. That could be a good idea. Yeah, no, definitely. Cool. Yeah, so I think, we're just running out of time for our discussion. But yeah, this is a really cool technology to look into, and also my weak signal with BugBots. Great conversation, John. Thank you for coming in about this post-secondary education idea. Tune in for next week for another episode for Future Friday. You can check out our other episodes on Spotify and also on Apple Podcasts. Until next week, see you then. Thank you.